Hello, listeners, and welcome to the AfriWeto podcast, where we look to celebrate African history, people, and culture by telling our story. As always, our hope is that it fills you with enough curiosity to go and do your own deeper research. Karibu to any new listeners to the AfriWeto world. We invite you to check out previous AfriWeto episodes, which can be found on this podcast platform. Thank you so much for tuning in today. We are headed to the west of our continent for part two of the amazing Ashanti Empire, one of the most famous empires globally. A shout out to my West Africans out there. AfriWeto is back on your shores. I also want to apologize for the mispronunciation of words that will most definitely happen. Before we begin, please remember to visit us on our socials. Our handle is at AfriWeto across all our social media handles, where we shall be posting interesting facts, stories, updates, and links for further studies for all you lovely people. But for now, just sit back and enjoy the journey. So, there is a heck of a lot to get through in part two. So let's just step into the past, journey to meet our African ancestors. And if you haven't already, make sure you check out part one. It was packed with all manner of dope history, I promise you. Now, before we dig in, you should know by now what I'm going to ask. Please pull out those maps and let's get ourselves familiar with our surroundings, okay? So, as we said in the last episode, this empire's physical borders were essentially what is today's modern-day Ghana. Parts of Côte d'Ivoire and Togo as well. However, its influence was felt a lot wider than this, all the way across West Africa, reaching modern Niger, Liberia, and Benin. There have been claims that the population numbers were an impressive 4 million people, which, considering that era, was huge. But because I do love all you AfriWeto, I'm going to do a short recap of part one. So I got you. We went back in time and found ourselves in the royal courts listening to the Ashanti storytellers narrate the origin story. It was magical. We met Osei Tutu I briefly. He was the first of his name and the occupant of the Sikadua Kofi, which is the golden stool. This stool holds all the Ashanti souls. We then heard about how the empire started from a small confederation of different states bonded by their successful defeat of the mighty Denkyira kingdom that at that period dominated the Akan states. And from there it just kept on growing. We then went in and looked at the governance. We met the Ashantehema, who co-ruled actually with the Ashantehene, and also met the Ashante Kotoko, all of whom would deliberate on crucial matters concerning the state as the official council. So we found out that the ruler did not have absolute power. Then we went into the military and expansion. We got to meet them and understand through its efficiency why it was inevitable, to be honest, that the Ashanti would grow from being the kingdom based out of Kumasi to the empire it became. It went ahead and conquered lands left, right, and center, building its influence and power in the process. In this episode, we shall hear a little bit more about the economic factors that led to its influence, and we shall understand a bit more about the societal setup. We will also meet a few well-known rulers and then finish off with a brief look at the end of the empire. So now, let's dive right in, okay? So, as you'd expect with an empire of this magnitude, a key source of their wealth and dominance was, yep, you guessed it, trade and a very strong economy. Osei Tutu I oversaw the expansion of the Ashanti using the military to secure trade routes, as well as take precious goods from the conquered as parts of the spoils of war. Wealth was then further generated through the tributes that were received from the states that had been captured, as well as through the very high taxes that had to be paid from the income generated by trade or anything else by these states. The access to the coast was hastened after they defeated the Denkira, which is also, as we said, part of what kicked off the Ashanti imperial period. But despite this victory, there was still a lot of resistance, and they still faced concerted efforts by other kingdoms to keep them locked out of that trade space. States such as the Akim, the Akwapim, the Fanti, the Twifo, and the Wasau. The middle southern states, who on occasion would form an alliance to deliberately block the trade routes and frustrate the Ashanti's direct access to lucrative trade routes. In fact, in AD 1765 and AD 1772, the Ashanti were restricted to the Kumasi-Accra route, leading to then Accra becoming a major port and depot for Ashanti traders. The biggest fear that they had was of the Ashanti getting unfettered access to the trade on the coast, which was very lucrative. So, what were the main types of trade of the Ashanti? First, we shall start with that of the indentured peoples, indentured African peoples. As I'm sure many of you are aware, the West African coast held ports on the last journey for many enslaved people. The Ashanti controlled key ports and they were involved in the transatlantic practice of selling indentured peoples. In fact, it was a prolific actor in this, and today one can go and see the so-called slave port monuments, such as the Elmina Castle Museum, as one of the 30-odd ports to remind us of the tragedy that was Africans who were sold off to work in the Americas in the worst conditions known to humankind. May we never forget that very bloody, inhumane period and never again allow for such evil treatment of Africans ever again. We owe it to remember their lost souls. Next, we have the rubber trade, which came in after the abolition of the indentured people. Rubber was linked not just to the Ashanti, but also other civilizations across the region. The traders who were involved in this managed the supply chain from hiring the workers and lands to actual trading. And it is said that they're the ones who laid the foundation for the later cocoa industry. And speaking of cocoa, we can segue nicely to cola nuts. See what I did there? So the cola industry was huge during this period and was on par with the gold industry in this region. I kid you not. In fact, it was a preferred method of payment for goods and services, including that of servants to work the trade routes as administrators or even payment of porters. It was also used to buy gold dust as well as nuggets. The industry from harvest to production to trade was very lucrative. In addition to trading in key goods like gold and ivory, you could also find in that period items that included foods like yams, plantain, groundnuts, fish, and a lot of crafts, materials like silk, printed cloth, etc., etc., etc. So when it came to those who were trading, so the actual Ashanti traders, there were a various number of traders who operated in this ecosystem. So you had those who were selected from the royal households and would be sent out annually with special orders, basically buy cola, which would then be traded in other markets. They would then be accompanied by one heck of an entourage befitting their station and orders. Apparently, the trade routes were shut down when they were sent out on this annual duty. You then had the Douadini, who traded within the state's borders, local traders, if you will. You then had the Batani. They were specifically long-distance traders who had political clout and were able to secure state protection for their routes and markets, and they worked outside of the state borders. And then lastly, you had the large-scale traders who held large commercial operations and whose actual livelihood was trade. They actually professionalized it, building commercial businesses with paid or hired labor. They operated mostly between the northern markets and either the coast or the cola-producing regions. So now we've talked a little bit about the traders. Let's hear more when it comes to the society of the Ashanti. But to get the tone for this section, let's take a trip to ancient Kumasi, the seat of power of the Ashanti. We arrive and are greeted by the Afena Suafo, the royal sword bearers. Entrance into Kumasi was not a casual affair. Visitors had to wait for word from the central government as to whether or not they could enter. The answer was then conveyed by the Nkwa, the royal servants. They did not play, my people. It is said that if any visitors were given access without express permission, the Ashanti held responsible could be executed. We wait. Phew, we get the invite. As we walk into the city, we can see how well it has been kept. It's clean and orderly. As we walk, we note the public services like sanitation and toilets and rubbish centers just dotted around. We look across the road. We see about two men heading out, followed by folk who look like us. They were not from these here parts. Our Efena Sofu tells us that these two, the court criers, are the ones who've been dispatched to escort these guests out of Kumasi. Our guests can only leave once leave has been given. He says, our government assigns a guide for all important guests, just like I have been assigned to you for the duration of your stay. We continue down the signposted streets. As we look ahead, we see a high wall, which our guide tells us is the perimeter of the royal palace and its grounds. And it is here where the Ashantehene and the Ashantehema lived and ruled from. It is also here that they convened the Ashante Kotoko, the council. And there they deliberated and made decisions for the empire. We keep walking under the shade of beautiful banyan trees which line the streets. Then one of our group asks our guide to use the bathroom. He takes us to a friend's house that is just round the corner. We come to the doorway, walk up the clay steps and into the thatched and breezy home. The toilet was all the way at the back, tucked in a hollow space. So off our pal went as we were invited to sit and have some refreshments. Yes, please. The kola nuts were prepared to perfection. As we step back out, there's a heck of a lot more people about. Our guide tells us that the traders had arrived. It was the season. Usually, Kumasi has a small number of people, but during these times, we get full and there will be lots of parties. I wish we could stay, but it's time to go home. Our guide escorts us back to the exit because we only had a day's pass. And in a flash, we're back. So let's start by acknowledging that the Ashanti adopted a lot of their culture from the larger Akan group, from which they were a subgroup. For example, the matrilineal clan system. With the Ashanti, this line was bonded from generation to generation through the female bloodline that was called the Mogia. And the male Ntoro, which was the spirit of the bloodline from the father. The Ashanti had eight main clans. The Oyoko, meaning the falcon. The Bretuo, the leopard. The Agona, the parrot. The Asona, the crow. the Aseini, the bat, the Adwana, the dog, the Ekwona, the bull, and the Asakiri, the vulture. The Ashanti adopted and absorbed cultures of those who they conquered as well, such as that of skilled crafts of weaving, woodwork, or pottery. These artisans were favorites of the nobility, who then ended up becoming patrons of artists, allowing for creativity and expression of their art. The artisans were then taken from their homelands to live in the royal courts. So you can only imagine the beauty and the creativity that one would see in these upscale neighborhoods and in the bigger cities of the Ashanti Empire, right? And speaking of the nobility, let's look at some of the other aspects of society, starting with this particular group. Now, as with any self-respecting African, especially our West African fam, statement dressing was everything. And with the Ashanti, you could tell one's status through very distinct styles of dress. And the nobility? Well, they would distinguish themselves with various items of dress and regalia. I mean, they had lots of gold, this we know, but they also used ornaments made of beads, glass, as well as silver. And then, on top of that, in addition, they had silk, leather, beautifully woven materials and cloths, the famous kente designs and such like. And in fact, when it came to kente, it turns out that there were certain designs that were reserved just for royals. Other items found in these circles included crowns for rulers, as well as specially made swords, staffs, and even drums, all as part of their regalia. And then, depending on their status, we come to the importance of noble houses and their stools. In fact, I think it's worth taking a quick look at the role of royal stools in Ashanti culture. Ashanti stools play a huge part in their culture, and their significance can never be underplayed. A stool is presented at key milestones in life, from birth to rites of passage to death. Only the high-ranking officials and significant people got royal permission to then adorn their family stools with intricate detail and precious metals. The ancient Ashanti would decorate these, as well as special ornaments that would be collected from conquests, family heirlooms, commemorative of special events, and so on and so forth. In addition, you'd find associate with the stool other items ranging from swords to musical instruments like drums to specially made woven cloths. The most famous stool, the Sika Dwa Kofi, the golden stool, was covered by Afriwetu in part one when we spoke of the origins of the empire, so be sure to go and have a listen. But because I care, to summarize, this is the most important and sacred of all Ashanti stools then and now. It is said to not only be from another plane of existence physically, having come down from the sky on the auspicious day that is Kofi Friday, but it also embodies the spirit or souls of the Ashanti people. The stool united the ancestors and their descendants and is a symbol of Ashanti identity and culture. And since Osetutu's reign, the Ashanti Hene has been the sole custodian of this particular stool, which also means by default, that holder also holds the soul of the Ashanti people and is their custodian. Now, even as you think of the Sika Dwa Kofi, it's also good to think about the black stools. So these stools were usually dark in color and called black stools, and they were treated with a varnish that was made of egg yolk and soot. The stools were usually attached to noble families, but not just any, but those that had lineages of significance. They were sacred objects and were seen to inhibit their past custodian spirit and provide protection to their families. When the head of a family died, their stools were preserved and kept in a special stool room. This would have either many stools or would only hold that founder's stool or just the one stool that belonged to a special person from the family. This was an honor that was bestowed upon them, as they were seen by this act to then join the ancestors in their passing. There were exceptions to this rule, mainly when a person was destooled and when they would not get this honor of resting with the ancestors. Actually, the stool was of greater importance than the person, so much so that one could be destooled for gross acts that defiled the high status of said stool, and they could actually be replaced. I've realized I've said stool a lot. Anyway, There were various reasons how this could happen, which was also applicable to the Ashantehene. And they included going against the laws and regulations, including excessive cruel acts against the people, breaking set traditions that would cause shame and be deemed sacrilegious, and even, every African relates to this one, defying your elders. These custodians were held to very high standards and always had to act in a manner that was in accordance with the strict constitutional rules and customs. So, if you go back now to the social structure of the Ashanti civilization, picking up from this the role of elders, they were highly respected and held in places of honor. The traditional ruler, the Nana, was also very well respected and enjoyed this rank regardless of education or level. When it came to the wealthy and political elite, such as the nobility, they were known through, as I said before, a particular type of dress, the number of slaves that they had, and the amount of gold and silver that they possessed. The wealthy included those like the Asikafo, the business people like the merchants and traders, and also those who came from rich families like the Nkwankwa, who inherited their wealth. Upon their death, heavy death duties were then paid, and their wealth was absorbed by the state through the process of Awunyade. And this wealth was then seen to be a part of the nations, and the Ashantehene, as the nation's representative, would take control and be responsible for redistribution to the appointed beneficiaries. Then from the top, we move swiftly to those who were lowest on the rung of society, the servants and the slave. A common term I found was Ahiafo, relating to them as well as the general population. My Afriwatu from the Ashanti descendants, I would appreciate you sending Afriwe to the correct terms for the mentioned as well as the correct pronunciations, please. Anyway, when it came to these in the lowest rung of society, there were various ways someone could end up in this category, from conquered peoples and prisoners of war, to criminals, to banishment, a loss of a family name and lineage, to those who had been stripped of their rank because of their political offenses against the state, and some were simply born into it. Those who fell into this category ranged from laborers, for traders and farmers, as well as servants in noble homes. Some were even skilled artisans who would be found weaving and creating wood carvings for the wealthy classes. Now, this next section I wanted to add here, because at Afriwetu we cover the great, the not so great, the interesting, and everything else in between. Enter the practice of human sacrifices. Yep, human sacrifices was something that was not at all uncommon to our Ashanti ancestors. So, those who are on the end of this, and basically those who usually fell foul of the axe, were in these same lower rungs of society. Your slaves, servants, as well as captives. There were various reasons as to how one became a human sacrifice. It was used as a death penalty sentence, sometimes as offerings to the ancestral deities during the festivals, or when the chief died and his household were to accompany him to the next life. That could suck. For the ancestral offerings, these would take place at festivals and funerals. The unlucky souls would be sacrificed in the appointed manner to appease them. Ancestors played a huge role and were integral to societal beliefs. They were believed to have control over the elements of weather. Thus, droughts were a sign of their displeasure, as were instances of disease and misfortune. Equally, rewards in the opposite were true and seen to be a sign of following the correct customs that honored the ancestors. So anything that was good, thank you, ancestors. When it came to the funerals, such as that of an Amanhene, which is a chief, those who were sacrificed to accompany them would not only be their selected servants, but also wives and other family members. And those who had led exemplary lives were also candidates to be honored as ancestors. So these events fell under the umbrella name of Adai, a time of mourning where the reaffirmation of loyalty to the ancestors was made. There were two types of Adai, basically the Great Adai and the Little Adai. Lastly, the use of human sacrifice was also quite simply a death penalty for a criminal offense whose sentence was just that. Offenses included, I kid you not, adultery as well as murder. Whew. Now, my people, as you can imagine, in an empire such as this, there were many Asantehenes, like for real. And when doing the research, this is a whole episode in itself. And it was much to just keep track of the political intrigues and succession battles. So a very early caveat, I had to keep it short and simple, mostly for my sake. So up next, we shall briefly look at just four leaders that Afriwetu found to be interesting characters, okay? Our first is none other than the founding father of the Ashanti Oseku, Kofi Tutu I, circa AD 1660 to AD 1716. We had a little bit more info on him and how he and his chief priest, Komfo Anyoke, sparked the flame and set up the people to become a great empire in part one. He spent a great deal of time in his youth as a page boy in the Dankira courts under Boa Aponsem, and also had a stint in the influential Akwamu kingdom. From this period, he picked up and learned a great deal of his tactics politically and militarily, which he then adopted and implemented in his Ashanti kingdom with great success. Osei Tutu I was the first of the sacred Sika Dua Kofi and also established the roots of the Apagya stool. This is one of the most prestigious of the Ashanti stools and from his time has always been associated with wealth and closely linked to the royals. What Tutu I did is that he started the tradition and customary requirement that all future Asantehene's wives must come from the maternal line that was the same as his wife. Her family were from Dankira and had provided him with support during the war. So I guess this was his eternal thank you. Osei Tutu I's rule was not only successful, I mean, he's kickstarted the empire, but he also therefore built a great legacy. He died during the campaign wars with the Akim in either AD 1712 or AD 1717. And yes, it is still up in debate from the research. My Ashanti Nation people, hit Afriwetu up to help clear the mystery. What say you? Anyway, next we have Nana Opuku Ware I, who took over from Osei Tutu I, who was actually his maternal uncle. Basically, his mother was Osei Tutu's niece, Nyako Kusi Amoa. Now, this dude really took it up a notch and is said to have been the most prolific conqueror Asantehene there was. He conquered land and peoples left, right, and center. And he started by avenging the death of his uncle by taking up the war with the Akim, and when done, continued in the process, took Dangomba, Gonja, Giaman, Sefwi, Kahawu, and loads more. His reign also saw the increase in Ashanti wealth and opulence, the emergence of new markets and trade corridors, as well as what was acquired as bounty from the many, many conquests. Next, we jump ahead in time to the early 19th century to meet Asantehene Osei Tutu Kwame from AD 1801-04 to AD 1824. He was also known as Osei Bonsu. Now, the Osei Bonsu's name meaning is just too dope, so of course Afriwetu has to share. So legend has it that he was the first Asantehene to see the ocean, and on reaching its shores on the beaches of Anomabo, turned to the Fante, who he had just conquered, by the way, and asked, "What is the biggest beast in the sea?" The reply, "Bonsu, the whale, for it can sink ships." So guess what? Yanni, gosh, I love our African people. Asantehene on that date declared, "From today, I shall be called Osei Bonsu, Osei, the whale." Please, my people from the Ashanti lands, if you could send the correct pronunciations of these phrases, I'm sure the Afriwatu would be very grateful. Anyway, for this name reason alone, he had to be on this list, right? But actually, there was more to him than just his name. He was also known as having been a very successful military ruler as his forefathers, Osei Tutu I and Opoku Ware. His expansion of the empire to the Atlantic Ocean is greatly celebrated to date. And then, our next person of interest, or our last person of interest, is Ya Akia. Or, many know her as the formidable woman that was Ya Ashantewa. Born in AD 1837 and died circa AD 1921. Now, because she is just such a phenomenal woman, Afriwetu has to have a separate Legends episode just for her. I mean, it's only right. So for the purposes of this episode, this is just a very brief introduction. Ya Ashantewa was a shrewd and politically brilliant mind. She was also a fearless woman in the face of strong opposition from the invaders and an inspiration for her people, rallying them to fight with the Ashanti pride for their freedoms. She was of noble birth, born into the royal courts, and her star really rose later on in life when she wrested power from her brother Mensa Bonsu and her mother, the Ashantehema of the time, Afua Kobi. She kept herself and her family in power through political alliances and strategic marriages of her daughters. In fact, it is said that if her sons-in-law did not perform their part in supporting her, she had them killed, banished, and then took her daughters back. She was instrumental in getting her young son, Prempeh I, elected as the Ashantehene in AD 1888. And in AD 1896, just as he and his mother were making progress in the creation of a more stable and solid Ashante, guess what? The usual happened as the European foreigners invaded and came about to wreck things through their interference, and he was deposed. This was a huge blow to an already fragile state that was already a shadow of its former self. And then, my people, and then, to add insult to injury, these same foreigners sent an envoy who then dared to demand to sit on the sacred Sikadua Kofi. I mean, imagine the sheer arrogance. Well, all hell broke loose because Ya Ashantewa was not having it, and she galvanized the Ashanti warriors to stand up and fight for their dignity that was being threatened. She is claimed to have said words to the effect, and this is my own interpretation, I will admit, "The white man came and ravaged our land. They took our Ashantehene and our chiefs, exiling them from their homes. And now another claims to sit on our beloved Sikadua Kofi, defiling our ancestors with this crude behavior. They, with no culture, will never understand its place. And in all this, where are our men? Where is our pride? Have you all become cowards? You should exchange your loincloths for my garments." Hey, this call to arms was heeded. She and her people took to arms against the invaders, and then so started the Ya Ashantewa War of 1900. There is a quote from her that I just have to share, which just showed she wasn't just talk. So apparently, when these foreigners called on her for negotiations, her response, "I have loaded my gun and not for nothing." And then people, and then I read that her put-downs were so epic, because even when she was captured and she was on her way to being taken from exile, according to an eyewitness, and this is Albert Mawere Poku's mother, who said, "Ashanti women, I pity you." Someone then asked her, "What about the men?" Ya replied, "Which men? The men died at the battlefront." And then she turned off and walked off. Respect, because why lie? African women just rock. At this point, it's a good time to have a very brief look at the demise, as the end of this war was one of the many causes of the end of the Ashanti Empire once and for all. The fall of this empire was not to do with any single or defining moment, nor was it due to a single external player. I mean, this was a massive and powerful state, so it could never be so simple. In fact, the fall was mainly exacerbated by internal issues, basically the conflicts. The bane of success is that everybody in a successful nation wants a piece of the action. A lot of the power struggles, specifically between AD 1750 and AD 1891, in the ruling classes, were manifested in the succession disputes and coups, which caused civil wars, weakened the empire from within its own core. This is a common thing when we look at empires across the ages, and the Ashanti were no different. There were quite a number of significant events and way too many to list here, so please go and read up on it, because there's a heck of a lot of information out there just waiting for you. Here we shall just mention a few. So we already heard about the Ya Akia and her fight against the invading foreigners. Now before this, because this was really the tail end of the demise, there was the infighting between Kofi Karikari and Mensah Bonsu, which then spilled into the empire, and the territories that were agitating for independence really took advantage of this instability at the top, seeing their way out, took it. Then the Ashanti army started to lose their shine of invincibility, losing key battles that lost them territory. The powerful Kumasi chiefs as well, whose positions had been strengthened over the years, started to exert their influence so much so that they were even able to overthrow Ashanti Henes, and in some instances were able to impose their own choice of Ashanti Henes, ignoring explicit instructions. The empire's economy was also hit by the abolition of indentured people trade and the diminishing gold in the coffers due to a lot of mismanagement. Then their territory started to outright refuse to send their own troops or indeed tribute to keep funding the empire. And with no cash, how can you run an empire and even maintain your armies? The simple answer is, you can't. So by the time of the various wars with the foreign European invaders, despite fighting valiantly, the Ashanti army was in a weakened state, and they were weakened severely after the AD 1873-1874 war, and then again in AD 1869. The empire was decimated, and the final nail in the coffin was the end of the Ya Ashantewa War in 1900. So what else was going on in the world at this time? In 1611, the King James Bible was published 800 years after the Orthodox Geers Bible, which had already been published in the 6th century. In fact, the Geers Bible is the oldest and complete Bible known as the Ethiopian Bible, which has about 81 to 88 books. In 1616, William Shakespeare dies. 1631, Mount Vesuvius erupts. In 1644, the Manchus overthrow the Ming dynasty in China. 1708 to 1709, famine kills one-third of East Prussia's population. 1720 to 1721, the Great Plague of Marseille. 1789 to 1799 was the French Revolution. And in 1793, the yellow fever epidemic kills about 10% of the immigrant European Americans. So now, as we close, this was one heck of a civilization to study, and it was such a joy to bring it to life in these two episodes. But honestly, this really is the tip of the iceberg for real. The original pre-colonial Ashanti Empire spanned like 200 years and some change. Imagine that. And this empire has influenced a lot of modern culture, music, clothes, art, books, politics, globally. In this empire, we saw yet again how our ancestors revered we, the African women, and just how amazing our ancestors when it came to doing, well, everything, really. There were so many fascinating things, from the origin stories with Komfo and Osei Tutu I, the Sifa Kwadifo, its great military and its expansion, to the societal structures and rulers. I mean, I love that council idea and having the Ashanti Hene basically beholden to their decisions. To be honest, it's a real struggle to just pick a few. So I'm going to try something and I'm going to take the easy route and ask you, the listener, to share on our socials or leave a voice note on the Anchor app about what your highlight was from these two episodes. But also, AfriWet would love to hear from those who are descendants of these mighty people, those of the Akan, and would love it if there's some things that were not covered in these two episodes that you can share with us across our socials. And on that note, it's time for me to sign off and say goodbye. So, until next time, Mubarikiwe!